I first knowingly encountered the idea of irony when I heard Alanis Morissette's song, Ironic. I was 10, and the song was so popular back then that one couldn't turn on the radio without hearing it at some point within the next 15 minutes. As a 10-year-old kid, I felt like this song opened a window into a forbidden adult world, a world for which I was not yet ready. Alanis was singing about white wine, about cigarettes, and had even used the word damn. Even today, when I hear it, I somehow feel sinful. The guilt from my childhood resurfaces once more. Be that as it may, all know the accusation so often raised against this song. None of the situations named by Alanis are actually ironic, rather they are coincidences. It's true. It isn't ironic that someone needs a knife but instead only has 10,000 spoons. It's also not ironic when a black fly finds itself in one's Chardonnay. For many years, until far into adulthood, forgive me if I do not reveal the exact age, I am ashamed to admit that I didn't really know what irony was. I recognized that irony was awfully important, particularly for literary studies, and yet, I just kind of pretended I knew what it was, even though I didn't really. In any case, once I did figure out what irony was, I understood that those strange situations in Morissette's song were just that. Strange. But not ironic. By no means. Maybe, then, it isn't so inexplicable why, to this very day, I still tremble before this song. For as this episode will show you, irony is a concept which will seduce you, haunt you, and ultimately leave you feeling vanquished. In order to deepen my understanding of irony, I could think of no person more suited and qualified to interview than Erika Weitzman. Erika is an associate professor in the German department of Northwestern University. She did her PhD in comparative literature from NYU. Her first book came out in 2015 and was entitled Irony's Antics, Walzer, Kafka, Roth, and the German Comic Tradition. Her second book came out in 2021, entitled At the Limit of the Obscene, German Realism and the Disgrace of Matter, which discusses obscenity as an aesthetical and ontological question in German realism. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the introduction and for this invitation. It's really exciting to be invited to speak on a podcast. I look forward to it.
It's great to have you here. So before we get into the philosophical stuff, I'd like to ask some just biographical questions.
Sure.
I'm actually interested in... I myself, we're both Americans that became Germanists, mm-hmm. and scholars of German literature, and I'm just fascinated by how other people also got onto that path. So what got you into, as an American, what got you into German literature?
So as I was saying to you before we started the podcast, you know, my way to German literature was not really a straight shot. I'd always been interested in literature ever since, you know, I was reading, and in world literature, I guess. And you know, some authors I just discovered through, you know, you hear about them, they're famous, you hear the names in the air, and I guess I was curious about them or just browsing in the local public library. I remember one of the first books I checked out of my local public library once I graduated to the adult section was Kafka's Metamorphosis, which was also, interestingly, one of the first times, or maybe the first time, that I'd ever seen an annotated edition. It had footnotes in it, so I found that very exciting too, which probably determined my future career.
irony I'm also fascinated by. And it's a word that is very much in our discourse, sure. You know, popular right. discourse. Right. I think a lot of people use it not necessarily knowing what it means. And for me, it's pretty fascinating. And, you know, as we know, Kierkegaard wrote a whole master's thesis about irony. So it's a pretty pretty important philosophical concept.
For sure.
What got you into irony?
I mean, I'm not, you know, these are sort of career developments that happen, you know,
it's gradual.
Gradually. And yeah. I can't like date the moment where I started thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, zooming out a little bit, I've always been interested, for a long time, I've been interested in questions of style and mode in mm-hmm. literature. So like, what does it mean that a particular kind of style or mode or mood or form, let's say form, occurs at this particular moment in time, or becomes dominant at this particular moment in time, or is not dominant, but right. happens anyway. And that's something, right, that I've been curious about for a long time. And especially things that don't seem to quite fit the official narrative. I mean, one thing, this is not about irony, but comedy. One thing that I think I could pinpoint is when I was at the New School, the great Agnes Heller, who was a, she died about 4 years ago, but she was a student of Georg Lukács's, and she taught a course on the philosophy of comedy, which I took. And in some ways it was a wonderful course, but I also found it very frustrating. And she wrote a book based, you know, based on the research that was presented in that course. And I think, unfortunately, I think that book is her last book, and I also find the book very frustrating and not particularly sufficient. But I think, you know, out of that frustration, like, this, yeah, what is the philosophy of comedy? Wow, like, there can be a philosophy of comedy. I think that really opened my eyes, and even the fact that I was frustrated with the conclusions that she came to made me want to explore further. I mean, one thing I think that I see that you're trying to get at is also, you know, irony as a sort of pop cultural phenomenon. And I am a child of the 90s. So I grew up in the age of the dawn of the ironic t-shirt and ironic air quotes and ironic so-called postmodern irony, which actually has much more to do, I think, with the longer tradition of irony, including romantic irony, than is generally acknowledged.
Rather often, and particularly in American culture, when we say that something is funny, what we really mean is that it is ironic. Situations can be ironic, and these situations are often inherently humorous. They seem to happen when the precise opposite of our expectations is permitted to occur. There is, for example, an episode of The Simpsons in which Homer and Apu travel together to the first ever convenience store, the first ever Quickie Mart. That Homer and Apu need to travel so far and wide just to reach a convenience store serves as an example of situational irony. The instances named by Morissette in the song Ironic seem to not quite work because they aren't exactly opposites of what we expect. If it were to rain on your wedding day, this wouldn't be ironic, for rain alone does not contradict a wedding party. Say, however, that the party were held indoors due to the possibility that the guests might get rained on. At the very moment at which the bridegroom was preparing to cut the wedding cake, a drunk guest decided to light a cigarette. The smoke from the cigarette migrated upward, triggering the sprinklers and causing all of the guests to get rained on. This would be situational irony par excellence.
So right, so like first you've got verbal irony. So irony is a trope, is a rhetorical trope. You use it to create certain effects, and it does mean saying one thing and meaning something else, or meaning the opposite. So like, right, I mean, you know this, but like if I say, nice shirt, you know, and you know, because of the tone of voice, that I mean, I hate your shirt.
I
don't hate your shirt.
Could just say, excuse me, sir, I don't like your shirt.
Exactly.
That would be non-ironic.
Yeah.
But instead you say, nice shirt.
Right. And
it's the same meaning, but said in a different way.
And it's interesting to think about, you know, that already as this simple rhetorical trope. Like, what is the work that that's doing? Why don't I say, I think your shirt is funny looking?
Yeah, I think that's so interesting that why do people choose to communicate indirectly, ironically?
Right.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, one way that that's been talked about, I think, is as a way, you know, sometimes more, sometimes less obvious, of creating like a coterie of meaning. Like say there's a bunch of people in the room and I say, nice shirt. And you're like, oh, thanks, I just bought it yesterday. And then everyone, you know, then I have established, and everyone laughs because they understand me. And so therefore I have created a connection with my audience at the expense of you. And, you know, since rhetoric, as you know, is initially for the public forums and courts of law, this is a way of the lawyer or the rhetorician to connect with the audience and present his or her opponent as an idiot, right? And if it's privately between two people, maybe, I don't know, you know, you can go into the psychology of passive aggression and all kinds of things. But so that's the first level of irony. And the Greek iron comes from dissimulation. So irony is originally a form of dissimulation, not lying, but concealing one's meaning. Remind me to come back to this, because I think like there is a way in which like more complex forms of irony, let's say, or like more later forms of irony, actually do have to do with that kind of simple verbal sarcasm.
Where does romantic irony fit into all of this? After all, romantic irony has little, if anything, to do with sarcastic, verbally ironic statements like, nice shirt. Nor does romantic irony have much to do with situationally ironic moments like a fire station catching on fire. Romantic irony was theorized by the German romantics in the late 18th and early 19th century. Historically, they were writing during an era in which the French Revolution had called into question the very idea of a king's right, well, to be king at all. Philosophically, they were writing in the aftermath of Immanuel Kant's critiques, through which Kant argued that human cognition was incapable of knowing the thing in itself. Suffice it to say that, during this time, negation, doubt, and indeed revolution were in the air. None of this, however, really answers the central question of what romantic irony is, a question which I have, at least so far, tried painstakingly to avoid. What is romantic irony? Here, I need to be honest and admit that there is not such a straightforward answer to this one. Certainly, romantic irony cannot be as neatly summed up as verbal irony, in which one, to quote Cicero, says one thing and means another. Nor can it be as readily summed up as, say, dramatic irony, in which the audience knows something that the character on stage does not know. Finally, it certainly can't be summarized so cleanly as situational irony, in which the opposite of our expectations is that which occurs. In fact, there is a reason why it is extremely difficult to define romantic irony. The reason is that romantic irony was largely theorized by the German romantic Friedrich Schlegel. Not only did Schlegel avoid precisely defining romantic irony, but the romantic irony he theorized, so to speak, inherently prevented him from doing so. Schlegel's writings on irony are poetic, cryptic, and elusive. They are fragmentary and paradoxical. And that is precisely the point. This, I think, is what makes them ironic, romantically ironic. They say what they want to say by not saying it, by dissimulating, by beating around the bush, just like, in a way, all of those other ironies do. Finally, this was, for the early romantics, negation with a purpose. Ironically, the early romantics negated in order to proclaim. They fragmented in order to complete. They are beating around the bush, not to avoid the bush, but to touch it with their sticks, if only for a moment. You are listening to The Shrift, Interview 16 with Professor of German, Erika Weitzman. Bishalach.
Around the, you know, in the age of what's now called Romanticism, around the turn of the 19th century, both in the wake of the French Revolution and the wake of the Kantian critique, in which, just to like summarize it in a really awfully brief way, he established that there's no access to actual things, but only to our perception of things. Mm-hmm. So both of these things, obviously, like very disturbing for the security, for the epistemological security, for knowledge of people at the time. Mm-hmm. And people are trying to think about. Not people, a small coterie of writers and philosophers in Germany, or in what was not yet known as Germany, are thinking about the ideal, are thinking about ideals and mm-hmm. thinking about concepts. Mm-hmm. And they're thinking about these historical and philosophical revolutions, and thinking, like, if nothing is stable, if kings can be beheaded, and if divinely appointed kings can be beheaded, and if I don't have any access to the truth, only my own perceptions, you know, what does it even mean to talk about the ideal? And so people are these small groups of people. Have different, you know, are developing different ideas. And I also want to stress that, like, you know, this is a very, like it's kind of a bunch of, you know, it's a bunch of kids trying to figure things out. Like, these are, I mean, very smart, very, very gifted.
The three romantics, you mean?
Yeah, they're romantics. Like, they're, you know, teenagers and 20-year-olds. And I don't say that dismissively, but I'm saying that this all, you know,
Schlegel was like 20, 21.
Right, Novalis was like 16 or something.
Oh, really?
I don't, maybe a little older.
They were all, yeah. Tieck was very young.
Yeah.
And
so this idea of irony is a way of thinking, it's a way of thinking about the concept, it's a way of thinking about the ideal from a post-critical and historical perspective. So if you don't have any access to the ideal per se, if you don't have any access to the mm-hmm. thing in itself per se, mm-hmm. what can you do? You can continue to create. You can continue to destroy things and create things.
The early romantics, ironic as they were, originally held out utopian hopes for romantic irony. Erica's work theorized that, without the utopian horizon, romantic irony becomes comic. At some point, the Romantics gave up on their utopian vision for irony and instead asked where irony goes when truth itself is no longer in the picture. Incipit comic irony. Irony with the space, perhaps the empty space, to play, to be silly, to be comic.
Let's say this. Let's stick with this idea of irony as negation, as the negation of the phenomenon in favor of the concept. But for the early Romantics, negation here becomes, and this is all what, also why Hegel is such an interesting figure in this sense, it's also the force of history. It's the force of revolution, it's the force of what's new, it's the, like, you need to be perpetually negating because of time. Mm-hmm. Because of time and because of the accumulation of things. So every phenomenon sort of negates the other phenomenon, and the only thing you have is, you know, the collection of that amongst your friends or amongst your perception or in some sort of like larger, you know, mega artwork / philosophical work that will be developed in the fullness of time. And so there's no, so in a sense, like, irony becomes the force of history and the force of creation. So whereas, like, in Socrates, it was negation as the negation of the phenomenon in favor of the concept or the idea, in the early Romantics, it's also that, but has like a more, looser, more poetic meaning, and it becomes, in a certain sense, it becomes the force of creation itself. But again, without the force of creation itself, and also the force of value creation itself. And I mean, that's why someone like Hegel finds this so objectionable. Even if he recognizes that values are historically determined and change all the time, he still wants to like hang on to normative values and thinks that like the early Romantics are a bunch of immoral wife-swapping libertines, which, I mean, they were to a certain degree.
Mm. Certain decadence in this thought.
Well, I mean, from his perspective.
From his perspective,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's irony becomes the idea that I hate to put this in any sort of like apposu or like, you know, soundbite, but it becomes the idea of the force of poetic creation, that one poetically creates one's life, that one poetically creates one's world, that one poetically creates one's universe, and in the course of time and work. I mean, so this is why I wanted to tie it back to verbal irony in a certain sense. So to go back to the example, like, if I say nice shirt, we have the word nice, we have the word shirt. What the reason why irony, we have the word nice, we have the word shirt, and usually, you know, through context and verbal cues, it's very clear what I mean. If I say, oh, nice shirt, like, you can pretty much
understand. That was genuine, right?
That was genuine. Okay. And if I say, nice shirt, you know, like, if I make it nasal, I don't know why, someone should explore why nasality and irony have seemed to be tied together. Anyway, right, but the troubling thing about this is that means that, like, the words don't have any meaning, don't have any inherent meaning. And of course, again, through context, through tone, you know, that's how language works, No words have inherent meaning, obviously, but irony is the trope that highlights that in particular. And so sort of extrapolating over to romantic irony, you could say that nothing has inherent meaning. So there is a connection, even a long winding one, between verbal irony and romantic irony in the sense that no phenomenon, no thing in this world has an inherent meaning. And that's also why, you know, the romantics are anything but nihilists. And they want, you know, they hold on to a notion of the ideal that will be, you know, even if just as a far horizon in the fullness of time. And so what I'm claiming is comic irony, late irony, is that kind of romantic irony in which no phenomenon in the world has an inherent meaning or a foundation, but we've abandoned the horizon. We've abandoned the utopic horizon. It's no longer that everything will somehow be gathered up, either in the Hegelian sense of the fulfillment of history and the achievement of absolute spirit, or in the Christian eschatological sense of the second coming.
So that's where the playfulness comes in, where it's,
exactly.
There's no, the only point of this is just kind of play, fun, silliness.
Yeah.
There's no end goal or end purpose, yeah.
Yeah.
Could you maybe give an example of what you mean by romantic irony? Visualize it better or understand it better, like something and why it's romantic irony or...
I'm not sure if I can. Maybe okay. I should be able to. If I mean,
maybe Faust somehow is romantic. Or,
no, okay. No. I mean, maybe you could interpret it, but that would be stretching things.
Okay.
Or that would require complicated maneuvers that will keep us here until 9 p.m.
Okay.
But I will say that Schlegel's essay on incomprehensibility is perhaps not only the best example of romantic irony, but in a certain sense, like it is the sort of pinnacle of romantic irony, in which he himself kind of annihilates the utopian horizon that irony had. And he has this wonderful list in that essay, which is an ironic list of, and I can't quote it. I wish I could quote it verbatim, but. Like he has this whole list of different ironies. He's like, and the irony of irony, when irony runs wild, and it just goes on and on. And maybe you can like splice a reading of that into the finished version or something. But so I see that essay as also a kind of transition point to what I'm calling comic irony in the, you know, that appears in the early 20th century. I mean, Schlegel himself, of course, converted to Catholicism and became devout and sort of gave up on that kind of playfulness. But the essay on incomprehensibility is really the pinnacle of that.
We are the unknown unknowns, cell structure standard, objective unknowable.
In the corresponding episode of this Schrift interview, Season 1, Episode 16, I introduced a thought experiment. I invented three characters, Lou, Larry, and Logan. Each of them steps outside on a day which is beautiful and warm and sunny. Lou steps outside, stretches his arms to the heavens, and exclaims, "Ah, what a beautiful day we are having." Next comes Larry. In the face of the beautiful weather, he raises his arms to the skies and shouts out, "Wow, what lousy weather we're having today." his listeners immediately know that he really intends here to describe the weather as nice and pleasant. However, he achieves this effect by characterizing the weather as the exact opposite of what it really is. Finally, Logan strides outside. Logan, just like Lou, confirms the sunniness and the beauty of the day. However, like Larry, he changes his tone such that what he wishes to convey is galaxies away from the meaning of the words he actually says. Yet, unlike Larry, it is entirely unclear what precisely it is which Logan wishes to transmit to his listeners. As the example with Lou, Larry, and Logan shows, irony, it seems, has a tendency to run wild, or better put, metastasize. As with all innovation, there remains an irresistible temptation to outdo that which came before. The irony of the last generation so quickly becomes passé. It is not enough just to be sarcastic anymore. Instead, we need to be sarcastic about sarcasm. And then we need to be sarcastic about being sarcastic about sarcasm. And on and on. Can irony ironize itself so thoroughly, so ad infinitumly, that it just closes in upon itself, mocking, so to speak, the wind? Here, I'm reminded of another episode of The Simpsons, which I also brought up on episode 16, season 1 of The Shrift. Homer Simpson walks across the stage at a concert festival, Lollapalooza. Homer is famed for his ability to get hit in the stomach with a cannonball and not, well, die. Two concertgoers in the crowd see him come on the stage. One remarks, "Here comes that cannonball dude. He's cool." The other says, "Are you being sarcastic?" With a sigh, the former remarks, "I don't even know anymore." Much like Logan in my thought experiment, the concertgoer in The Simpsons speaks ironically, but without a target, without anything to ironize. Schlegel seems to have hit upon this literally devastating phenomena over 200 years ago in his essay, alluded to earlier by Professor Weitzman, on incomprehensibility. Schlegel wrote, "Finally, there is the irony of irony. Generally speaking, the most fundamental irony of irony probably is that even it becomes tiresome if we are always being confronted with it. But what we want this irony to mean in the first place is something that happens in more ways than one. For example, if one speaks of irony without using it, as I have just done, if one speaks of irony ironically without in the process being aware of having fallen into a far more noticeable irony, if one can't disentangle oneself from irony anymore, as seems to be happening in this essay on incomprehensibility, if irony turns into a mannerism and becomes, as it were, ironical about the author, and if irony runs wild and can't be controlled any longer." What this excerpt from Schlegel shows, above all else, I think, is how irony functions a bit like a Pandora's box. Once it's been unleashed, there's no going back. It metastasizes, becomes unwieldy, and eventually begins to attack itself, such that we must sigh in absolute despair, much like that lost soul in The Simpsons. Yet, can irony ever really be about nothing? Can it ever fully cancel itself out? Fascinatingly, what I understood from Erica is that irony can never be entirely pure. It always exists in a context, which means it always has a target of some sort. Okay, it's a beautiful day outside, and you have three gentlemen. One is named Lou, one is named Larry, one is named Logan. Lou walks outside and says, "Gee, what a beautiful day, the sun is shining, I'm feeling good." Larry comes outside and says, "Oh, what lousy weather we're having today. It's really raining a lot." Okay. And Logan comes outside third and says, "Wow, this weather sure is beautiful. I'm gonna maybe get my surfboard, go to the beach because it's so nice out." Remember, it's a beautiful day.
Right.
How would you describe Lou, the first guy?
in terms, is he ironic or not ironic? Well, I mean, he's pretty clear he's not ironic.
Right, right. I mean, as I said to you before, I'm not sure how to wrap my head around this thought experiment, frankly. I mean, the one thing I will say, and actually this, not to be completely nerdy, but it kind of gets back to Schlegel's On Incomprehensibility, just the title. I mean, irony, well, okay, first of all, I would say, you know, all of these things are within the realm of verbal irony. And verbal irony is a hermeneutical question. In other words, it's a question of understanding. So you need context. I mean, okay, you've given some context. You say it's a beautiful day. So if it's a beautiful day and one person says it's a beautiful day, I guess that's not very, I don't know
that's
how that would
direct.
Be.
That's just direct.
That's a pure statement of fact. And if someone says, goes outside and says, on a beautiful day, what a lousy day. I mean, it's weird actually, because usually the example is the opposite, right?
Yeah.
That usually, I mean, a common example that's always given is it's raining outside and someone says, great weather we're having.
Yeah, I could change it around, but.
Well, and so you have to think about like the motivations, like why, I mean, sure, verbal irony either way, it's a counterfactual, but like, what's the motivation? So like, if your second guy is saying it just to be nasty to the first guy, or is he saying it because he's depressed, and then it's not really ironic, he's just depressed?
He's not with the first guy, he's just speaking to himself.
Or maybe
to his friends.
I mean, I guess, right, I mean, I just have to think about it, right, more hermeneutically, more psychologically, if you would, like, what is his motivation for saying that, and...
This is the guy that says it's lousy weather when it's beautiful weather, right?
I mean, it's a counterfactual. I'm not sure if it's irony, unless he's meaning it in a particular way to undermine something else.
Well, it's just, I mean... It's really just the same as somebody, well, not the same, but when it's bad weather, you say, ah, what beautiful weather we're having, right?
Well, that, I mean, that actually gets to questions of, you know, because why does someone say that? Because I think people do say that.
All the time, yeah.
But, like, why does that,
like, oh, great, you know.
Yeah.
Which one, not great.
Right. But it's like a sort of consoling...
Lucky me.
A consoling humor. And this is how humor is often spoke of as a sort of making something... Looking on the bright side in a way that it's clear that you're not really looking on the bright side.
Some kind of consoling, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So, therefore... But I don't quite understand what the motivation would be for saying it's a nasty day when it's a beautiful
day. Maybe just to be funny or something, yeah.
Right, but then who's the audience? And so, I mean, all I'm saying is, that's why I have my trouble wrapping my head around the thought experiment, because I need more context.
Maybe
no
one would ever make that joke. I know someone probably would. Okay, well, I'm mostly interested in the third guy.
Okay.
Because there it's like... Yeah, I mean, for me, the third guy actually resonates with your theory about comic irony.
That's funny, because the third guy I don't understand at all.
Well, I think that this is...
Because isn't he just sort of
confirming? It's nonsensical. What beautiful weather we're having. I'm just going to go get my surfboard, head to the beach.
Are they around a beach?
Yeah, they're near a beach. Oh, no, they're not near a beach.
Okay. You see, it's complicated.
Oh, okay. Well,
I don't know. I would read that it's like, I actually, it's just the same as the first guy, unless he doesn't surf.
Can I give you, maybe I give, it's the nice shirt example.
Okay.
You see someone... Or let's use a car example.
Okay.
He has a a Porsche, beautiful Porsche. No one, and you could say, "Hey, nice car," or you could say, "Wow, you got a real lemon there," you know, like a real beat up. But he's really saying it's a nice car. Right. The second guy, and the third guy says, "Oh, I really love your car. It's really fancy. It must have been really expensive."
Oh, I see that. Oh, I see.
But it actually is fancy and is expensive.
But so, I mean, again, but he says it in a nasty way.
He said, yeah, and I mean, if I'm just, for me, this is like, you can't tell what his purpose is in this comment. It's totally, for me, I would say it's just being silly, just being playful, just having no purpose other than this kind of,
I mean,
and that's where I saw it as actually comic irony.
I don't think it has much to do with comic irony. I think,
okay, or with Schlegel's like incomprehensibility, where is he being serious? Is he not? What's his purpose?
Well, okay. I mean, but that's why, I mean, irony per se is indeterminable. And you've got, I mean, I always find myself recommending this book, even though I don't like this book, but maybe I think it's apropos for your thought experiment. Wayne Booth's A Rhetoric of Irony. So Wayne Booth goes through and really like anatomizes all the possible uses and motivations for irony, mostly in literary works, but also in verbal speech. But I think, in terms of your thought experiment, I mean, you would have to do that kind of interpretation. Like, if he's saying, "Oh, nice car, you must be really rich," or like, you know, "Nice car, you must really be good at your job," and you know, then that's clearly irony, and he's clearly doing it to make fun of the person and suggest that he doesn't deserve such a nice car, and he says, You must be really good at your job, because I really think that actually you're just a rich jerk and you don't deserve this nice car." Or he could be saying, "Nice car, you could be really good at your job," but then it would just be sincerity. Or he could be saying, "Wow, that's the most beautiful watermelon I've ever seen," and then it would be just like nonsense and dada. But I think you would have to think about what the context is. There cannot be any purely ironical statement. There cannot be any ironical statement per se.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And
there's always
and irony is always, as Schlegel says, irony is, or no, does Schlegel say this? Someone says this, maybe I say this. Irony is of understanding. Maybe Paul de Man says this. The reason why irony is such a problematic trope is because it's the trope that puts meaning itself into question. Unlike a metaphor, I mean, arguably, all the other rhetorical tropes in classic rhetoric, but irony doesn't have anything to do with the literal words. It's all context and tone and meaning. So you can say a word and never be rigorously sure how it's meant, and that then like explodes out into all language. And so at the sort of absurdist edges of that, you can be like, well, no words have any meaning that we can possibly rely on, which is strictly true, although obviously conversation happens all the time.
So there would be never, you can never make a I'm staying with the car example.
Sure.
That car's ready for the junkyard.
Right.
But it really means, that's an awesome car, man. Like,
right.
Pretty. But then there's, like you said, I'm actually like this watermelon example. If I go up and say, "That's a beautiful watermelon. Maybe I'll take a bite of it." Right? Like, it's so hot outside. To me, that would be like totally nonsensical. You said dada, but you think actually even there's some kind of purpose or some kind of like point?
Well, again, it depends. You know, maybe you're hallucinating. Maybe you're on drugs and you actually think it's a watermelon. Maybe you're just trying to be silly and playful and that's your sense of humor.
Right. So there's some reason for the comment.
I mean, all of these things are matters of... Right, you have to interpret them.
Okay.
One thing I was thinking about is, it kind of goes with the, like, your car is such a lemon, like the way in which, you know, good friends will, like, rib each other by calling each other idiot or something like that, you know, like, you know, what does it mean when I go up to my, I don't generally do this, it's not the way I'm socialized, but, like, you know, when people go up to each other and like, hey, idiot, like, hey, butthead. In that case, it's like, right, you can't express affection directly, so you express it ironically by saying the opposite, by insulting each other ironically, knowing that you're actually expressing affection, because
totally.
Affection is in some sense forbidden. And in your car example too, like, you say, like, ugh, what a heap, when you want to express genuine admiration, but that would be sort of too exposed.
It almost ironically shows a certain, if I say to the person, you have a beautiful car, sir, that's a compliment for the car, but it says we're kind of, there's a distance between us. Whereas if I say, that car you got, that's a real lemon, it's nice to the car and it's saying, hey, we're friends.
Right, right.
So it's like, I mean, that in itself is ironic, that being indirect is making you closer.
Well, I think, that goes back
to the... That would be situational irony, I think.
No, this is verbal irony.
Oh, okay.
Well, I see, the making you closer.
Yeah.
But it kind of goes back to the nice shirt. And, you know, because irony is a matter of... Because verbal irony is a matter of understanding, it's sometimes used, and these are good examples of that, to create a coterie of insiders. So you're standing there all alone in your poor shirt, and I say, like, hey, nice shirt, and everyone laughs, and you're excluded, and I've made and you say, oh, thank you, and you're excluded, and I've drawn a connection with these people because I'm playing on the ambiguity of the word. But if you really know, then you'll get the irony, and if you don't know, then you won't get the irony. So same with, you know, hey, butthead, like, you understand, you get me. You understand that we actually are friends, and I'm not actually being aggressive to you.
Right, because if someone that you would never call, well, I think what I'm realizing is just irony is, it's so contextual and so many factors, and you can really, like, play with it in so many ways to convey different meanings.
Absolutely.
And you can't, I think it was awesome that you pointed out, well, where is there a beach nearby? Like, these questions, actually every detail shifts the meaning slightly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome.
Once again, it's important to remember that situational irony is not the only type of irony. Far from it. Even more common, if not 1,000 times more common, is verbal irony. Sarcastic remarks fall into this category. If someone says, well, that's just great, we immediately know how ungreat it is. But the types of irony expand further. As discussed, there is Socratic irony, romantic irony, dramatic irony, and even more. And what holds all of these forms of irony together? They all function through a kind of deception, whether sinister or well-intentioned. With all of them, there lies something hidden beneath the surface level.
Is there a difference in the worldview of somebody who, like, says, this weather is terrible, and the person who says, wow, what a beautiful day we're having. Can you, I know it's like,
sure.
How would you, which one's like?
I mean, well, I think the answer is kind of, I mean, obviously, you're talking about someone who only speaks in sincere.
Yeah, and I think there probably are people like that.
There are. I mean, there are certainly people who have no sense of irony, right?
Everything they say is what they mean, and yeah.
Right.
I guess
the answer to that is pretty simple, right? The person who has no sense of irony, who always says what they mean, who doesn't understand irony when other people say it, the one who's like, oh yeah, thank you, I like this shirt. Is both sincere and maybe unable to see other sides of things. Whereas the person who, whatever, either uses verbal irony, we're just in the realm of verbal irony again, is able to, doesn't take things as much at face value.
Yeah.
Or is less in the habit of taking things at face value.
I would say that's fair. And what about someone like the watermelon example that?
I feel like I'm speculating on the psychology of these fictional people based on one thing they've said about
yeah.
a car. So that's very difficult.
Okay. That's fine. I guess what I'm trying to get at, and this actually goes back to what you said about growing up in the 90s.
Sure, right, yeah.
Is that, like, it seems to be that there's a certain cynicism that goes with irony, and if the cynicism goes far enough, it becomes, I would say, maybe nihilism.
Well, nihilism is one of the words that comes up all the time in discussions of irony, especially, we're moving away from verbal irony into a more, let's call it Socratic or romantic form of irony. If you don't think that there really is something out there, some sort of absolute truth or salvation, then I think the destructive quality of irony is put into question. And I think that's a little bit where I was going with my idea of comic irony, and I think that's where the authors that I talk about are going, that they don't have this idea of some sort of absolute truth that is therefore going to be achieved through the gradual correction of error.
Mm. The Torah obviously came to be long before verbal irony had become so culturally dominant. When the figures in the Torah speak, they almost always mean what they say and say what they mean. Not always, to be sure, but surely almost always. Nonetheless, a noteworthy exception to this rule occurs in Exodus chapter 14, verse 11. The Hebrews have just fled from Egypt into the desert and into freedom. Pharaoh's soldiers, however, are hot on their tails, pursuing them and hunting them down. They come to the Red Sea. They see the seemingly uncrossable water and hear the galloping horses of Pharaoh's ever closer growing army. They know that they are lost, and so they cry to Moses, "Was it due to a lack of graves in Egypt that you brought us out here to die in the desert?" What, in fact, did the Israelites really wish to communicate when they hurled this passive-aggressive accusation at Moses? And why did they decide to formulate their words in this way? they're leaving Egypt. They get to the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. What? And they see the Egyptian army coming basically to kill them. And they are really worried and upset. The seas haven't parted yet. And they say, "Hey, Moses," you know, they said, I'll read it out loud. "And they said to Moses, 'Was it for want of graves in Egypt that you brought us to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, taking us out of Egypt?'" So my question for you is this, would you say this is an ironic statement?
I mean, when I looked at it, I don't know if I would really call it ironic. I mean, again, it would depend on what kind of irony you mean. I mean, it's definitely
Verbal irony.
Right. Well, it's not verbal irony, because it is literally saying what they mean. I mean, it's maybe almost more like a form of wit, where they're putting two ideas, like a classical wit, where they're putting two ideas together. I mean, maybe it's, you know, I could see it as the earnest statement would be, "We're really scared. We think we're going to die soon," and then
right.
I mean, it's hard, I think, for us to read this passage it's hard not to read this passage with like a certain borscht belt intonation, right, in the background.
Well, that's how I was introduced to it.
Yeah, exactly.
My rabbi, like, "Was there not enough graves in Egypt that you had to bring?"
Yeah, exactly.
yeah, but
I have, you know, we'd have to, you know, I have no idea how people would have read this in, you know, the 14th century or the, you know, first millennium. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, yeah, to me it's like, sounds funny. I don't know if it's irony, but, you know, it's
or maybe
funny.
A little bit of sarcasm. But you can't, you can't say.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah. Right, like they want to say they're scared, and instead they sort of deflect in this passive-aggressive manner and say, like, "What, weren't there enough graves in Egypt?"
Right, it's kind of like, "Thanks a lot." They're not really thanking him.
I'm afraid I don't have anything particularly interesting to say about this the passage, except that it is super curious. I think it's hard not to read it with modern ears, but it's easy to read with modern ears and therefore interesting.
I also think it's interesting that the very next sentence is it almost like. It just says, "What have you done to us, taking us out of Egypt?" Now it goes immediately reverts back to very direct speech, right? It's like, now they're just speaking. There's no hiding.
True.
So it's like this little, it's almost like he regrets even speaking ironically.
Well, it's a collective.
They. Great point.
I mean, it's definitely like if it's irony, it is that kind of verbal irony where you, maybe where you say one thing, like you make some sort of claim, "Oh, there were probably no graves in Egypt, and that's why you had to bring us here," but you actually mean, "You idiot, what have you done to us?"
Right.
So yeah, sure.
Yeah. Here we can only speculate, and I was asking you before about like what the worldview of somebody who speaks ironic, what ironic speech suggests about a person's worldview. I find it interesting that they're slaves, and maybe would you say this puts them in a positive or negative light in terms of.
Oh, I know that this is your podcast and this is part of it, but I feel on very shaky ground trying to interpret the Bible and the worldview of the Israelites in the desert. I mean, I guess it goes under the category of which there are, you know, there's a lot of examples of the Israelites bitching.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, and I think bitching could potentially it often is often done ironically, I guess.
I mean,
there's certain, at least today, not in the Torah.
Right.
Definitely
not
in the Torah, but I think, oh, thanks a lot, like these kinds of phrases.
Yeah.
I'm gonna adjust my luck, you know.
It has some of that. It has some of that.
I felt just really privileged to be able to sit with you and just get to ask you these questions, and thank you so much for your time, and it was,
so
much.
My pleasure, and I hope that I was halfway comprehensible in some of what I said.
You were. Okay. Verbal irony is not only about what one says. The manner in which one speaks tends to reveal his or her entire worldview. It is not coincidental that the mouthpieces of this sarcastic remark hurled at Moses came from those very same doubters who would later erect the golden calf. And yet, sarcasm has become outdated and even conformist with the passage of time. How far can the boundaries of irony be pushed and strained? What do we do with comments and asides whose only purpose is to confuse? What happens when the hidden meaning of a statement is so inaccessible that one must ask whether there is a meaning, any meaning at all, to be discovered? Have we finally arrived at a moment in history in which we can mock Alanis Morissette's ironic for its being too straightforward? Well, that would be ironic, don't you think?